It's Wednesday, October 26th, and you're tuned in to the latest edition of Highlander Newsroom, hosted by myself, Miles Andrews Dubay, editor-in-chief of the Highlander. Along with me is
sports editor John Hammond,
lead arts and entertainment editor Faraz Rizvi.
Same group as last week, man.
same group as always.
Yeah, yeah. Usual suspects.
So for you regular listeners out there, which I'm sure there are many, you're probably used to this group, so hopefully you like us. Hopefully we're tolerable at the very least. We have a few things to get to today. We want to talk about what's on the front page of the latest edition of the Highlander, which feel free to pick up a copy if you haven't already. Talking about the Heat Music Festival put on by UCR and the Hub, funded by the Hub Governing Board. Well, excuse me, funded by UCR Administration, but usually decided upon by the Hub Governing Board. It's been canceled for 2 years. And that 2 years ago when it was canceled, that was pretty much saying it won't continue any longer. At least that's the sense that administration has given off thus far. But now it's back in discussion again. Will Heat Music Festival, which happens, I believe, winter quarter, right?
Winter quarter.
Toward the end of winter.
Yeah, towards the end of winter.
And it's, again, put on by UCR. Will it happen again is the question. And if you have not read the article, just a briefing is that the Hub Governing Board met with UCR administrators, James Sandoval, as well as other governing board members, and in their first meeting of the year, and the discussion was about the allocation of the $500,000 that has been approved, but where will that money go? It's the two sides of the coin are Sandoval wanting it to be used to fund the expansion of the Hub and the overall campus expansion plan, and some members of the Hub Governing Board, as well as AACCR President Shafi Kareem, wanting it to go toward funding and providing heat for students. So I guess the general question to start off with is, do we feel like we need Heat Music Fest? And any of you could take that one away first.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go with I think we need it, mostly because, one, I think, like Shafi said, it's fun about the campus, right? Like, it's one of the things that you look forward to on campus, one of the things you can take pride in that your school does. And also, like, I don't think that the alternative, which is, you know, like extra meeting rooms, extra study spaces in the Hub, are more pertinent than Heat. I mean, granted, I haven't been to a Heat in the 4 years I've been here because, like you said, it was canceled or I was busy or like I had family stuff. But I still would like it to continue because all of my friends who have gone have loved it. They said it was really fun. They enjoyed it a lot. I mean, maybe they could push it back and make it more in the spring quarter and less in the winter, because I remember, like, my freshman year when it got canceled because of weather. Like, there was, like, a lightning storm, so they obviously couldn't perform on a metal stage. So maybe, like, they could change the time of the year to make it less susceptible to weather, I guess.
Yeah, I actually think I'm going to go in the opposite direction. I don't think heat is really necessary. You know, these concerts that we have, they're great, they're awesome, we love them, but they are ultimately a luxury. And with the proposals with Sandoval, while, you know, in theory, I don't really agree with the master plan, I think the idea of expanding parts of campus is really important. We do have, 1,000 more students than we did last year, and so I think it's important to kind of create more student space. There needs to be more, right? I mean, study spaces, like, it's so difficult trying to get a study room, you know? Especially during midterms and finals. It's, like, near impossible. So I think I think Hub expansion is really important. With that being said, I don't hate heat, and I'm not, like, super angry that it's going to be there. You know, I'm a fifth year. I would love to be there for it. But ultimately, I do think if we're really talking about what's pertinent, I think I would say that, you know, probably expanding the Hub. It's like, are they going to have heat and promise heat again and then have it be canceled due to weather again? It's clearly kind of, you know, an iffy situation.
Right. And, like, to piggyback off what you said, it does kind of seem like they're looking for a reason not to have it. Like, oh, man, it's, like, it's windy. We can't do it. Shut it down. Like, I would like maybe for them to pitch maybe other ideas for what the expansion could be, because I definitely don't want to see more restaurants. Like, I really don't think we need that. Study spaces, like you said, are certainly important. Like you said, you know, if it's midterm or finals week, you're never going to find a place in the library unless you were sleeping there for the past week. maybe they could even use it towards not just the hub, but like maybe like refurbishing campus classrooms that we already have. Like, I know they already are planning with like the whole family housing thing, potentially having more classrooms there. But how about we put that $500,000 into like refurbishing the classrooms we already have? Like, there are plenty of classrooms on campus where like the seats are trashed, the desks don't slide up all the way, or they're just like marred completely, or there's like, you know, the entire bottom of the desk is just made up of gum. Like, you know, maybe we could use it for some of that.
Yeah, no, I was just going to ask, Miles, do you know about, like, the funding? Can it be used in that capacity, or is it only put forth by the HUB governing board and can only be used for the HUB?
It's allocated toward the HUB, and I believe it can only be used for the HUB. Although that wasn't explicitly made clear, that's kind of, I think, what was the underlying assumption from my end when it was discussed at the meeting. It's, yeah, so it's $500,000, and again, it's been approved. It's just a matter of where it goes, or what it goes toward.
I think they were thinking about like splitting it up.
That's one thing. Yeah, Senator Dalshon Bolson raised that at the meeting, saying, "Okay, what if we split this? You know, 250-250. It would be less money for a HEAT, but it would still be a HEAT music festival, and it would also, you know, provide, you know, make both parties happy."
That's fair.
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I don't know usually how much money and what the money is used for when putting on this festival. You know, so I don't know if 250, how much more limited it would be. But one thing that Sandoval did raise during the meeting was that he wants to. It was an interesting kind of, I would say, maybe a contradiction, because one thing he raised was that, you know, the need to put on Heat Music Festival and putting it on, even if it's at a lesser capacity, it wouldn't be worth it. Like, so that's one thing he brought up. Like, it wouldn't be worth putting it on for 250, basically, right? Because it doesn't meet the standard of what he has been. But at the same time, he acknowledges that it hasn't happened for 2 years in a row, in which, I mean, most likely most of the students here would not be have any idea of what the standard for Heat is, right?
Right.
The majority of them. And at the same time, it's been so long that it wouldn't, I think people in general, students in general, would just be happy to have it. But I do, in general, leads towards where you cited, Faraz, where I'm not sure. I feel like it would be a contradiction on our end to complain about the lack of parking, complain about the fact that the student body is growing beyond the ability for us to accommodate them, and then at the same time say, but you know, we really want Heat. And while we're having already two music festivals and ASPBs, funding is going up to, I believe, $40 in the next in 2 years, in which they would be able to either provide another concert or enhance the two they already put on, Block Party and Spring Splash. So I think, you know, we all kind of have to, unfortunately, as students, maybe make this quote-unquote sacrifice, as, you know, we want to accommodate student body and have a better situation for all, you know, all parties involved. That's so, I do side with you on that. Do you have a point to make right now?
No, yeah. I was kind of piggybacking off what you were saying.
Yeah.
I was just going to say that, you know, I mean, you're totally right. I think the idea of like splitting it up is interesting because, as you were saying, like a lot of students who are here don't exactly or might not be as aware of what Heat was and the quality of Heat, especially for those first years and second years out there. They're really not going to know. So, you know, I think like it hasn't affected negatively my campus, you know,
experience.
And I've been here for 5 years. Like, I've seen Heat before. It's awesome. It's fun. When it, you know, last year when it didn't have it, did it really hurt me? Not really. You know, I, you know, it's
right.
Not having it, I don't think, will destroy anyone. But I think, like, you know, not having enough space on campus is pretty important. On that note, though, I do like this idea of splitting the funding. You know, even if they, if Heat is not up to par to what it used to be, or even if they choose to, like, not do Heat specifically, but another concert or festival in the winter that's just smaller, I mean, I think that'd be pretty cool, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think that's, like, a bad idea, and I do think that that would be the best for all parties involved.
Yeah, I agree with you, Froz. Like, maybe it doesn't have to, maybe Heat doesn't have to be, like, you know, a grand spectacle of of a festival. You know, maybe they can, you know, get by with $250,000. I mean, to me, that sounds like plenty. I mean, I don't know. You know, I'm not, I obviously don't make those decisions. I never have before, but I would think that you could probably put on a fairly good festival with, you know, $250,000. And I think, you know, as important as heat might be to some of the students, having a place to study and having, you know, a place like for commuters in the hub is just as important, if not more. And, you know, like you said, and like in the article says, by 2020, UCR is expecting to expand to like 25,000 and possibly more. So we're going to need that space regardless. So now is probably the best time to start facilitating that, if not already expanding upon what we've got already. And I think, you know, at least splitting it up doesn't take, you know, like Miles said, we don't have to make the quote-unquote sacrifice of heat altogether. We can maybe just settle for a little bit less for the greater good, which is, you know, space for students.
Yeah. One question still to be raised, though, is does the funding of the hub governing board, right, let's say this $500,000, even the $250,000, all goes toward the hub governing board and the hub expansion, excuse me. This is being funded by students who are currently here who likely won't benefit from the expansion in the future. And that's something that a lot of people or students I don't think would be necessarily okay with, right? And that's where I think a demand for heat happens, because it is that instant gratification of, okay, this is me funding something that I'm actually getting. I'm actually getting something out of this, and it's not going toward future students. So, and there was a similar situation raised with the SRC, right?
That's true.
It was the exact same thing, actually. So do you think that's another legitimate concern to be raised? And, like, does that in any way, should that in any way affect the administration's decision-making in this case?
I do think that's a legitimate concern on behalf of students, right? Like, where's my money going? But at the same time, you know, this campus funding is something the university does need. And if that money is coming from somewhere, and if that money is already allotted for the hub governing board, I think that using it for expansion would just make logistical sense on behalf of administrators. And while it is unfortunate that, like, say, like myself, who I'm done at the end of this quarter, won't be able to see that, I think still, like, it's important for the campus in general, you know, and it can be debilitating to try to make everyone happy.
It can be.
You know, yeah. It can be. And, like, with the SRC, it was the same issue. What they do, they ended up going ahead with it anyways. And the SRC we have is pretty excellent. And I think everyone here who's on campus who's enjoying that.
It's also very expensive.
Yeah, it is very expensive.
Especially if you're not a student who uses it. You know, it's a very fair, well amount, or well-represented amount of the student body who don't use it as well. And it's difficult, though. Like you said, you can't accommodate for everybody. What everybody likes and needs, especially at a university of this capacity and one that's growing. But yeah, I'll let you continue.
Right. Yeah. I mean, well, like, yeah, you are actually right. Like, you know, not all students use it, but they all have the capacity to use it, you know? And so I think, like, a lot of students do appreciate the fact that it's on there. Like, furthermore, I mean, if, you know, for students who are not going to be here when they start, they're always going to be fourth years when they start, you know? Are they only going to, you know, take money from, like, you know, people who are going to be able to using it? I mean, there's no way to get out of that problem where people who are paying into it will not be able to use it.
Yeah.
You know, like, there's, like, no matter when they start this funding or this, you know, expansion plan that they, because they have expansion plans and those are going to have to go through at some point.
They are, you know, going through.
They are going through. Oh, yeah. And, you know, no matter what, there will be people who, you know, whose tuition money went into it who won't be able to reap the benefits.
Right.
You know, and so to think about that, I mean, I think it's unfortunate and it sucks, but there's really, you know.
Yeah, it's the fiscally responsible move, though, because it's something that will, you know, if they do end up adding, which I'm sure they are adding more businesses and restaurants in addition to other parts of the hub and other aspects of campus, like the multidisciplinary research buildings they're adding as well. Those type of things will pay off in revenue, you would assume, at least. So it's more fiscally responsible than, you know, a concert, but it is also appealing. You do want to try to appeal to the student body. But again, for me, from my student perspective, someone who also loves concerts, two is fine, I think. You know, a lot of schools just don't have, and especially a lot of schools don't have, if they do have concerts, it'll be like maybe one artist, right? And these are like private schools that we'll have. And we have, you know, two with three or four, and then all these other attractions. So to me, that's more than enough. And then you consider Winter Solstice and all the Nooners as well put on by SBB. Yeah, I think we have a good fair share of, like, you know, entertainment in that regard. And it's totally an option for Heat to return again in 2-3 years when ASPB does get more funding, and which is imminent, to double their funding, I think, to 40, like I said. So, yeah, but we'll move on from this. And I know there are a couple topics of what discussion we wanted to get to, but we'll start with the one that's, I think, more pertinent, and that's WikiLeaks, right? It's a more broader subject, and it doesn't necessarily pertain to the Highlander, but it does pertain to media and the ethics of media. So, if Roz, you want to lead this one off?
Yeah. So recently WikiLeaks released, you know, massive dumps of data, which were a lot of them were collections, bulk collections of Hillary Clinton's emails, Hillary Clinton's campaign manager emails, and there was a lot of information that was released there. A lot of speeches she gave to private banks and institutions. A lot of emails between her and, you know, the DNC about, you know, Bernie Sanders and the Democratic nomination and how that process worked. And I think this leak is really important. It gives us a lot of insight into how the upper echelons of the Democratic Party and really the political party and political system work. And these are big institutions that are not actually facets of government, so we don't really have good understandings of how they work. And so just in terms of, like, the information it gives us, it's pretty valuable. At the same time, so Julian Assange, he released these emails. He's, you know, in Ecuador, or he's still in London, right? Or is he in Ecuador?
He's in Ecuador, I believe. Ecuador is the one who cut off his.
Yeah. So
access.
No, I believe he's in. He's still in London, but he's in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Okay.
Yeah, actually. So they cut off his internet after these dumps because they just believed that that he was tampering with the current election. And there have been a lot of issues with this because the founder of WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, really released all of this bulk data without really regard for any consequences on personal or individual lives. We saw some kind of weird things like the Blink-182 guitarist Tom DeLonge emailing John Podesta, who's her campaign manager, about aliens and UFOs, you know. But there were also some other concerning things like, you know, people being kind of outed as, you know, with mental issues, who those are private emails between them and, you know, whoever it was regarding, about like depression or, you know, just other various really private and sensitive information. And all of this information was released, and it's really like anyone in the world can see these emails that they share with this person that are very private. And so the issue does become like the ethics of this WikiLeaks dump and, you know, of bulk data collection and all these issues. So we wanted to spend some time talking about that because with all the election going on and, you know, with Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, I think this is a story that's been kind of neglected.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just on ethics alone, the part, like you said, okay, so people's now, you know, personal, you know, just ailments are now out. I would say, like, you know, in that sense, probably errs on the side of not super ethical. But at the same time, I do like how, like you said, all of, like, Hillary's emails, like DNC and other, like, campaign managers come out and, like, the speeches she gave to private banks. Because I like having that come out to enforce accountability. Because, you know, last thing I want, the last thing a lot of people probably don't want, is politicians making a speech telling us that they're going to defund huge banks, they're not going to let them do this, they're not going to let them do that, and then as soon as it's over, turn around and tell the banks, like, JK, we're definitely still funding you, you know, like, we just said that. So I like to see that, you know, stuff like that comes out because, like I said, it forces people to stay accountable to what they say, like, to the masses, as opposed to, like, doing their own thing once they get into office. But I do think that, you know, is that worth, you know, the sacrifice of other people's, you know, personal information? I mean, I'm not sold that's worth the sacrifice. But at the same time, I do, like, albeit it's not they on their part deciding for the transparency, but I do like, you know, the transparency of politicians, even if we have to force it out of them, you know, from WikiLeaks.
I think it's interesting that, you know, this has been, it's a story like we've both followed, Faraz and I think we all have, but it hasn't been a prominent discussion in the media circles, right? And it's I think 10 years ago, this would have been major, right? Okay. I think it's a testament to kind of how much of a driver the media has been in this election, and the fact that something like this can kind of, quote unquote, be pushed under the rug, because I don't think it's, you know, it's been more attacks on Hillary, or it's been more negative
Definitely.
To Hillary and her campaign. And I remember when I think the first couple leaks dropped from her campaign, you know, I thought they would be detrimental to her campaign, and there hasn't been any effect on it whatsoever. And I think that's an interesting thing to be raised, is just, you know, how in this current age where it seems like we are in such a need to know everything, or feel such a need to know everything, that the more we tend to know, the more desensitized and more less effective it is in many respects. And I think this is a great example of that. I know I kind of took it in a different direction, but it is kind of, that's something that I've been considering about this whole situation. Go ahead.
No, right. And I totally agree. I mean, you know, the fact that, and even if you look at a lot of like major journalists who are very, you know, staked in the election, a lot of them have found that, or have been claiming that, well, these hacks were sponsored by Russia and therefore are, you know, inauthentic, which is ridiculous because, like, the emails, for all senses and purposes, are authentic. They are real emails. And because of all this stuff going on about Donald Trump and his language and his racism and sexism, this issue with Hillary Clinton has been kind of, like you said, buried under the rug. And so the issue, yes, is, you know, the media and how they kind of spin and entertain these stories and ideas. But, you know, I think it's really sad to see this story kind of not get the attention it deserves, because it shows us so much about the internal dynamics of the Democratic Party, of how power really works in this country. For example, Hillary Clinton kind of going on record and saying that, you know, she believes Bernie Sanders' ideas about, you know, funding college and, you know, not bailing out big banks is completely ridiculous. Those are campaign promises she's been making.
Right.
You know, and so to kind of see like that backtracking, it's, you know, it's
right. Yeah.
You know, like I'm no Trump supporter, but I do find that very concerning as, you know, for someone who's going to be the next president of the United States, or perhaps the next president of the United States, while she is like leading considerably in the polls. So.
Well, and like to piggyback off something both you guys said, like, what Miles said was, you know, we're desensitized to the media, and what you mentioned, like, they are authentic emails. I think at this point, maybe people, like, don't believe that anymore. I feel like, you know, just, like, the average Joe who has a smartphone probably feels that at this point when they see these, like, oh, these WikiLeaks that come out, they're, like, even if they are authentic emails, I think people tend to just not believe them, just on the whole. Like, I'm sure people who are, like, staunch Republican probably eat that up and take it all for, you know, face value. But, you know, like Miles said, I'm sure at this point, a lot of people are desensitized to the point where they might not even look at that. Like, if you see, like, oh, like a headline on, like, on The Guardian, it's like, oh, you know, the WikiLeaks data, this is, people will just scroll past that because they're just so over it. Because maybe just because they're so, you know, disenchanted with this election or disenchanted with the political system in general, that they just don't care to read about it anymore. Like, for me personally, like, I agree with Roz, I'm no Trump supporter, but I'm also not 100% pro-Hillary. I'm pro more take 4 years off, hello to America, find itself kind of thing. Maybe we don't need to get into another relationship right now. But yeah, I mean, I think at this point, the average American is probably very fed up with just the fact that politics just becomes, you know, basically a rap battle at this point, where they're just insulting each other the entire time of the debate, as opposed to actually debating important topics. And so I think, like, when these WikiLeaks things come out about things Hillary does behind closed doors and things Trump does behind closed doors, people are just like, I don't care anymore. Like, I already don't like these people. I already don't like these candidates. What more could you show me to make me dislike them?
So you feel like there's an element of voter apathy that's kind of, you know, pushing the story down?
Absolutely. I feel like it's, while it is in, like, absolutely credible news, and it's definitely something we should be aware of, I think the fact that, you know, voters are just so apathetic at this point that they just don't care to see that anymore. You know, it's just like I said, they're just like, what else could they have done?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an oversaturation, and I think that's subsequent effect of that is apathy, as you put it. I think it's the best way to succinctly describe it. But it is interesting in an age where media is so much more accessible, yet seemingly less, if, or at least no more powerful than it previously was, right? At least maybe that's naive on my part, but it just doesn't seem like it seems like media is only powerful if it's adhering to the I guess what this current
like conventional narratives. Yeah.
Well, not conventional narratives, but in a way, but more so like if it's adhering to what's the popular interest of I think this current generation, and right. A lot of that isn't really in much of a way it's not very transformational or very important information, if I want to put it more bluntly, and that's a concerning thing, but. Especially, you know, coming from a newspaper perspective.
Right.
But we got a few more minutes here. I do want to get out and talk about Birth of a Nation, the film. I know Faraz, you wrote a review on it with no rating, a very controversial review. I'm on the UCR campus.
right.
But
I've heard plenty about that already.
Right, yeah, and so have I. But, you know, you expressed an interesting take where it wasn't necessarily... You didn't give it a rating whatsoever, but there was no... firm stance on what it meant, because it seemed like there was a dichotomy, I guess would be the way to describe it, between like the fact that it's a very powerful film, but it's also it's lacking very fundamental elements. So if you want to describe that in the next, I don't know, 3 minutes or so.
Yeah, yeah. So pretty much, so I reviewed Birth of a Nation. It's Nate Parker's new film. He produced it, directed it, acted in it. And the controversy with Birth of a Nation is that The Birth of a Nation was a film made in 1915, about 100 years ago, and it's pretty much like the most racist film in film history. It shows the founding of America as kind of these white Cape Crusaders who are, of course, the Ku Klux Klan, saving, you know, these women and these people from these savages who are, of course, you know, Native American and black. And so this year... there was a rewrite of that film, in a sense. So The Birth of a Nation, made this year by Nate Parker, tells the story of Nat Turner and the Nat Turner slave rebellion in the antebellum South before before the Civil War, in which Nat Turner, who was a preacher, goes on and, you know... preaches to the slaves on different plantations and kind of gets them to rise up and kill their masters. And this is like a very forgotten period in American history, but so influential. It was so important to how the South would look at slavery and freedom and, you know, the issues to come. And so Nate Parker's gambit is that this is really the founding of contemporary America, this racial divide. And so I reviewed this movie, and I didn't rate it because I felt like it's too complex to rate. I think when you're rating a film, you're kind of boxing it into, I believe this is this good on this numeric scale. And I felt like Birth of a Nation is very complicated, and that it was larger than any numeric scale or rating I could give it. Because the issue was that Birth of a Nation, while it's horrifying, the images in there are trenchant and powerful, and it's really it's angering. I mean, you walk out of that theater very, very angry and very upset that this is the reality of slavery. At the same time, there are a lot of elements that I, like, as a film critic, you know, can't ignore. There were a lot of issues with narrative, a lot of structural issues, like, for example, you know, the camera just panning again and again and again to, like, images of, like, the South and cotton, and it gets really old. The pacing isn't right. You know, I thought the score was actually... the same word I used in my review was atrocious. You know, it's very cliche. And so there were these things that I did not like. And that's come across as pretty controversial to a lot of people who thought that this film was much better than I gave it the review for.
It sounds like it was a good idea with just poor execution, right? Like, it could have been done better. Like, what it was trying to say was definitely valid. but maybe it just wasn't told right.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we got to get out of here. I did have some points I wanted to make, but that concludes this edition of Highlander Newsroom. Thank you to all of you for tuning in, as well as the KUCR staff. Again, no time for closing words, but we will be with you next week. Be sure to pick an issue of the Highlander, and thank you again.